one session this morning on hybrid data platform. So looking at how we can use a combination of on-premise SQL Server along with the facilities that are there in Azure, a lot of the new techniques and use the bits of technology that are available. We'll be having a look at that and just seeing how that can actually make you a better value of your existing infrastructure and what is available in Azure as well. Just a little bit about myself. I'm a data platform MVP, Microsoft trainer, consultant with Lobsterpot in Melbourne. The other one that I like to throw in just a little bit is with the SQL Saturday event in Melbourne. If anybody has heard of the SQL Saturday events, it's your opportunity for a one-day session to come and get deep dive into SQL Server stuff from a lot of great presenters. It's effectively free, so twist your boss's arm to come and have a look at that one. There's a note there on the slide. Obviously, you can download it later and have a check-in on that. So that's coming up in February next year, and we've already got a lot of big-name speakers set up for that. So if you want to get some more deep dive, have a look, see what the sessions are like. Register, come on down. It's a great event. So some of the things that I want to talk through with you today, really just thinking about how things are happening with organizations these days. So you're finding things like your databases are getting bigger and bigger, more complex. Sizes, obviously, and speed is obviously important things there. As you look at that, storage costs for on-premise are obviously going up. It's getting pretty expensive to get decent storage these days. Stuff that's there of legacy stuff, you might be finding it hard to add more storage onto your existing SANs. The ability to get SSD-based SANs in or storage for your SQL servers might be proving a little bit difficult. So there can be a lot of challenges there, a lot of things that make the organization struggle to cope with the expanses in data and be able to keep that running with their SQL servers on premises. So what we'll cover is a few of the new features. So the first one on it, the availability group replicas into Azure. It's not necessarily new. There's a few new bits that are added in, which we're going to have a quick look at. Is anybody actually running anything over an availability group into Azure at the moment? So that's all new to everybody as well. Okay, so we'll have a good look at that and see how that's running. One of the new functions in SQL 16 is stretch databases, giving that opportunity to have part of your data on-premise, part of it in the cloud. So there's some nice scenarios around that as well. And the various backups to Azure, it's something that was introduced in 2012. It's been enhanced pretty much every release since then. There's some even nicer stuff on the way with 2016. We'll have a look through that as well, see how some of the options all compare and what that can give you in terms of quicker, faster, better backup and recovery scenarios. And overall, you really just want to look at how we can make use of what's available in Azure along with what's there, make things easier for things like migrations. There's a lot of scenarios around being able to now migrate from your on-premise into Azure with practically zero downtime. So there's some nice things that we can do with things there. So the first bit I want to talk about is looking at the enhancements with always-on availability groups. And that slide obviously wasn't scrubbed very well with the spelling mistake there. So that was my little one that I'd left in for them to try and work out if they're doing their job properly. Obviously they're not, so I'll give them a rap on the head for that one. So looking at systems today and how things have developed. SQL Server, you're pretty much predominantly you'll see it on SAN. Is anyone using dedicated storage for the SQL servers? Any direct attached stuff still, or is it all on SAN? So everyone's pretty much all on SAN? Okay. So some of the things you're now seeing with SANs as well, adding in things like tiered storage. How many of you actually speak to your storage engineers and work out what tier your SQL Server data is going on to? Are you aware of that? Do you know if it's moving from tier one onto tier two, tier three on your SAN, depending upon how busy your SQL Server is, there might be that risk that you've got it dropping down onto slower disks. So there's interesting challenges there. However, in terms of looking at it historically, that was probably one of the first moves on making things more highly available, was getting it onto more highly available storage. So your first step there, getting things onto your SAN, getting things moving in terms of that enterprise level, and having that little bit more assurance that your data was safe. Moving on to that, you can start adding in things like clustering at the server level. Again, looking on that, it's giving you more availability at the server level. You've got that redundancy there. You've got the failover levels there. So it's a nice step down the journey. It still leaves, you know, your SAN as that single point, unless you start doing some clever stuff with replicating SAN storage and then being able to switch over the disks on that in the event of a failover. But that's far more complex level, needing an awful lot of planning and a lot of effort there. Virtualization then came into the picture. And once you've got it all virtualized, it then becomes a lot easier to start having a bit more redundancy in your servers, being able to take the whole thing with your virtual disks as well, and be able to fail that over between different locations. So, you know, again, you're adding in that additional level of redundancy, a little bit more availability in terms of your data. And then SQL Server brought out the availability groups, which gave us that opportunity to start doing, you know, far more interesting things on more commodity hardware as well. So we took away a lot of the reliance on the storage side of things there. We can have that multiple copies. We can have them, you know, in different parts of the network. We can have them on different subnets there. All that's moving towards making it far easier to keep your data secure, to keep multiple copies, and to make use of the infrastructure you have there. Obviously then being able to pull out things like read-only replicas, route some of your traffic to there, and take the load off your production server. And ultimately, as you bring down the load, you can have it running on something that's a little bit less. It doesn't have to be as big and fast as it initially was when you had everything hitting that one instance. So being able to, you know, disperse it a little bit more gives you a lot of benefits in terms of the redundancy, but also in terms of the performance as well. So the kind of setup at the moment, so with always on, you start off with, you know, at least two nodes in it, your primary and secondary. Normally you'd set that up on a single site for having your high availability at your primary site there. Available in 2012 and later, so it's still fairly new technology, but it's now starting to move on in a lot of different ways. Some of the restrictions there, you could have multiple secondaries, but only one of them can be in synchronous mode with those versions. And with multi-site clusters, it then gave you the opportunity to set up a direct link out to your DR site and have an up-to-date copy of your database available out there. Mouse seems to be giving me issues in moving the slides forward, so I'm going by the keyboard instead. 2016 really is putting in some great advances. Did anyone go to the Always On session yesterday afternoon? Yeah, a few of you there. So you'd have seen some of the new stuff with Always On in that session, which is really quite exciting with some of the stuff there. So a quick summary for those that didn't go there, some of the things that's been added now is, you know, the different ways that you can set up the clustering. So built on top of that with what's coming in Windows 2016, it's just opening up so many more opportunities for Always On. But within Always On itself, being able to then have you know, more synchronous replicas, so that's giving you the advantage there of having more real-time data dispersed out in your environment. The secondaries that are asynchronous can be load balanced. So if you've been setting them up for something like reporting, you can then distribute that load further over those reporting servers by putting a load balance over that. So you start hitting them in round robin manner. So again, taking some of the load off there as well, which is really nice. Basic availability groups for standard edition. So mirroring is finally gone. That's it. You know, get rid of your mirroring completely now. That's the replacement, is with the basic availability group in standard edition. It will support only two nodes, single database. So there's some restrictions around it, but it is pretty much, you know, the death knell for mirroring. The nice bit with extending it into Azure, so that was something that already was available, but with 2016, or before 2016, you still had a lot of fiddling to do in terms of how you set up listeners, what you had to do in terms of Azure load balancers, all that sort of stuff. The new wizard does that all for you. Pretty much it will take you all the way through, do all the configuration that's needed on that side, and bring you up to your replica sitting out in Azure there. It still needs you to have that initial cluster built up. So one of the bits there, you ensure that your primary is running on a cluster. So it's got the configuration around your cluster that can start to pull that in to then do the extension out to Azure. You then set it up, run the wizard, add a new replica in, tell it you want it to go to Azure. And that's pretty much it. As you go through that, click, 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 it then goes off, sends the script out up to Azure and builds your new replica up there. The other great thing that does with that, the other bit that's new with 2016 is distributed availability groups. What that means is as you build up your multi-site one, effectively you're building up multiple availability groups. So your primary on-premise one there is an availability group in its own. The one that's up in Azure, you've got multiple machines up there, again, that's an availability group on its own. But then you build another availability group over the top of that. So what that means is with the flow of data out to Azure, rather than having to forward out the log records to every single replica, what you do is you set up one of your instances to be a forwarder. So it sends it just to once, and then that resends to any of the other ones there. So in terms of looking at your bandwidth that you need to get your availability groups up into Azure, it obviously reduces that quite considerably down to just that one copy of the data now going across and lets Azure handle the internal distribution that way as well. So obviously looking at cost-wise of, you know, less data having to be pushed up into Azure, less bandwidth required, huge benefits overall. And what we can see from that sort of scenario is things like having your entire DR data center into Azure, because it's so easy now to get that full copy of what you had with your on-premise availability group for SQL Server, replicated up into Azure with that single easy connection up. It also then, you know, adds in some nice migration scenarios. So if you want to put everything up into Azure, start off with that, build up your infrastructure, have that one copy going across to keep it up to date. And then at the point in time where you think, yep, everything's ready to switch over, the rest of the infrastructure's up there, your app servers are all in place, all that sort of stuff, do your failover to the Azure AG as your primary and just decommission the on-premise stuff. So you're getting there things like no downtime migrations, which is some really, really cool stuff. Now I wanted to actually run this as a demo of actually setting things up into an AG replica into Azure. Some challenges with the configuration here that one of the things you still need is the site-to-site VPN, and with the setup with the conference center, I can't actually establish that for my demo machines up into Azure, so unfortunately can't run through that. What I will do with one of the next demos coming up is I will just show you how easy the wizard is, how little information it actually needs to then get to the point where you just click the button and off it goes. So we'll have a look at that in a bit as well. So as I mentioned, talking about the size of data, the data explosion, you're getting some very, very large databases out there as well. Is anyone working with anything that's over a terabyte already? Yeah, a reasonable number of you there. So you're starting to see that things are getting really, really big. And the challenges you've got around architecting for that. So I'm assuming you all use partitioning with those large databases on your tables. No? You should be. When you start looking at that, of tables that actually get into the hundreds of gigabytes in a single file group becomes an amazing challenge to actually keep that managed and well-maintained. You know, just think about re-indexing over something that size does make it, you know, really, really significant challenge. But what you'll find from that is with a lot of those really, really large tables, a lot of the data never gets touched. But when you go back to the business, you get, you know, the stories from them like, we have to keep that data. We can't afford to delete any of it. We can't clear any of it out. You know, that has to, we have to have that data available forever. So you say to them, well, can we archive some of it? Can we move it off into an archive database or something? And they go, well, yeah, maybe, but you know, what if somebody wants to query it? Then there's all this issues of hooking up to the different database and pulling it back and then making it available. So, you know, it maybe only happens 2 or 3 times a year, but it's a pain if we have to go through all of that. So, yeah, we do still need it in the tables to have it available online. As mentioned, you know, with your DBAs, talking about how do we actually maintain that? So the size of your backups obviously becomes, you know, really huge. And if you're not doing something like partitioning it out into different file groups and marking file groups as read-only so that you don't have to back them up every time and run your DBCC through them every time, you know, a lot of these challenges make it really, really difficult. And your maintenance windows are blowing out. You're finding that it's taking, you know, 4, 5, 6 hours overnight just to run the backup. And when you hit your re-indexing in DBCC, it's, you know, almost your entire weekend gone. And when that breaks in the middle of it, DBA is obviously getting called out and losing entire weekends to actually get it back and fixed again. And that often there's a lot of time where we can't actually really do anything in terms of any other, you know, clever solutions around that. You know, things like compliance and audit is another reason why things might be forced to stay within the same database and the same table. So with SQL 2016, they've now introduced stretched databases. And what that does is allows individual tables to be selected. And in the background, it does a little trickle feed of pushing it up into Azure. So it uses Azure SQL DB. It has a process that kicks in. Yes, question? So the question's about partitions. Yep.
This month to the top.
Yep.
Last month, the previous months before that.
Yep. So talking about partitions with, you know, part of it being hot, part of it being cold. And yes, that is a solution it can use. You can start using that, you know, the rolling window scenario and actually keep pushing it out. But you've still got that there on your on-premise database. So it's still sitting locally. It's still consuming all that space there. It's still part of your backup. It's still part of your maintenance routines. So it's still growing and growing on your internal storage, which is expensive. So the alternative solution to that, where you don't actually have to worry about partitioning, you can actually do this off the static table. It does still need a little bit of movement of data internally at the moment. I expect that in the future, it might not be in this 2016 RTM release, but I think down the track, we will see this being onto live tables because there's some challenges that still exist at the moment, which we'll go through. So what it does, it's got another background process that kicks in every so often. It looks at the table and goes, is there any rows I need to move out to Azure? It grabs those rows, it pushes them up into an Azure SQL database, which is using all the encryption at rest there. So it's using always encrypted. It's got an encrypted in transit as well that it sends up. So your data is secure that way. But the way it sets up the Azure SQL database doesn't make it open for querying. So you can't go directly to that database and query it. So the only access is from your system process on your on-premise system. Yes, a question.
So if you have stretched a table and say it's a 1 terabyte table, so previously if you are running DBCC check DB or DBCC check table on the table, so what happens to the stretched portion of the data? Does it also run on the Azure DB as well, in addition to the on-prem as well? Or how does it decide?
Okay, so the question is about your maintenance running on the stretched table and whether it actually only does the local part or it does the local and the SQL DP part. At the moment, it only does the local part, so it improves your maintenance that way. The SQL DB stuff is kind of managed by the Azure service, so because you've got the multiple copies there and the consistency checks underlining that with Azure SQL DB, it just decides that it doesn't have to do that, that you've got the multiple copies and it can self-repair up in Azure. Correct. As I was saying, the maintenance window, yes, it will obviously restrict, but you'll come down in size because you've got less data that you're having to go through. Another question. So the question is whether it's IaaS or PaaS in Azure. It's actually the PaaS. It's Azure SQL DB, so it's not a VM in Azure. Correct. You have to have the Azure account already, and then it will go off and actually just set things up for you when it fires off. Yes?
What happens if the population of its moving tables arose in the stretch part of the
Yep.
What happens if your site goes offline? What happens to that information? Does it lose track of where it was?
Okay. So the question there is about, you know, what happens if you lose the on-premise part of it and what happens to the part in Azure. So it's unaffected. There is some tracking that it does in between, you know, what's there and what's been sent up. So if you then restore your on-premise part, there's a stored procedure that you run which goes, hook me back up to the Azure part. It works out where your point in time is. So because you've got point in time restore with Azure SQL DB, it can work it out based upon your recovery and LSN stuff on the on-premise side. So what have you recovered to on that bit? It then syncs up to the appropriate point in the Azure SQL DB to give you complete consistency. So it will roll back if it needs to get some aspects there and back in sync again.
What happens if it goes the other way? Say your site loses connectivity to Azure.
So the question is, if your site loses connectivity to Azure, what happens? It just won't send anything. So the okay. Yeah, so the question that, you know, if I get it right, it's can you still query the stuff that's there into both sides of it? And yes, so if you query it through your on-premise and query something that has been moved, then the query will go and return those rows from Azure as well. So your trade-off there is your data is pushed out into, you know, cheap storage in Azure. It's rarely used. It improves things in your on-premise. But the trade-off is you get that increased latency if you do have to query anything that's there. Now, if you, at the moment, I believe that if you lose the connection to Azure and you try to query data that's in Azure, it will throw you an error message on that part at the moment. Okay, so the question there is if after CTP3, once the bit I haven't mentioned yet about in details about the predicate based, where you might have it set up of being a particular part of your data that you always keep hot, so whether it's, you know, the current month and the other data goes offline. My understanding at the moment is yes, that if you're only querying something which is in the hot part of the data, once the predicate part is enabled, then it will know that that data is only on-prem and will be able to query it. So in the same way as you can do partition elimination, I think that's my understanding is the same way it worked there. So it's smart enough to know, based on the predicate, that this data is all going to be hot and on-premise, therefore I can query it and give you that data back. I don't think that has actually been confirmed yet, whether it's going to be in standard edition. My understanding is that at the moment, it's probably an enterprise edition feature, but it's still quite fluid in terms of what's actually going to be in the different versions with RTM. So it may well come down and be part of standard edition as well, which would be really nice. So just running through that on the limitations there at the moment. Sorry, yes, another question.
Can we have an incremental stage? For example, we archive every last month's data and
okay, so it's asking about, you know, can we have an incremental stage? And that's just what I was exactly going to talk about. So with this, so at the moment with CTP3, the limitation is that it will move the entire table. So once you set up a table to be stretched, it will just keep processing that until the whole data has been moved up into Azure. As you add more data into that table, again, the process will kick in and it will feed that up. What's coming in a later release is then being able to specify a predicate. So I guess similar to how a partition function works, is my understanding as to how this is going to work, that you'll set up that function and it will say, based upon this predicate, do the rows stay in the local part of the table or do they move out to Azure as well? That is also going to be based upon individual columns as well. So you might be able to horizontally partition your table that way, or vertically rather, and say, these columns are the ones that always get queried. I want to keep them on premise, but these other ones hardly ever get touched. I'm going to stretch those off and put them out onto Azure. So in that sense, based on your predicate function, that will determine, you know, whether it is incremental and how much stays on premise and how much moves up. So if you've got something which is date based, for example, of saying, you know, as the earlier example of giving me the current month on premise and everything older, as the date moves, then it's going to pick up those additional rows on that extra basis as it ticks over each day and move those up onto Azure. There's issues with, you know, keys and things being transferred across. So, you know, unique and primary key constraints are not enforced. So that, you know, be aware of that aspect to it. Update and delete operations onto the cold part of the data in Azure are not permitted. So we haven't worked out exactly how to make it anything more than a permanent archive at the moment. So there's some challenges there, obviously, with the synchronization between things. The alter tables, you can't actually change the table structure once it's been pushed up, other than to switch on and off the migration state. The way around that will be to then effectively copy all the data from that table into a new table where you've made the structure changes, delete the initial table, and then if you want to restretch that one, you can do that again as well. And a restriction with index views, not being able to reference a stretch table, again, tied in with the indexing part of it being a challenge and things like that.
Can I ask the obvious question?
Yep.
Are those all likely to be restrictions?
So question is whether those limitations are all still likely to be a restriction in RTM. Yes, I would say so at the moment. I haven't heard anything to say that, you know, that is going to be an immediate solve. I think the solution is aimed out at data that's effectively been archived and not needing to be changed. So it's still queryable, but effectively you're saying it's not something I would want to update and delete anyway, so I'm not going to enable those at the moment. There definitely is scenarios of, particularly looking at deletion, where if your archive period is 7 years, for example, once it's over that, you might say, you know, on a a regular process of delete everything that's older than 7 years. So there is scenarios that are there that would fit into that. So I think that definitely will come. weather update comes. I'm not sure whether it needs something like that in that sort of scenario. I haven't seen a use case for that one as yet. So there's some bits around what you can do, what sort of tables you can actually stretch at the moment. So there's limitations on the data types. And most of this actually just ties in with some of the restrictions in SQL DB at the moment. So if you look at that, of the various data types that are not permitted in Azure SQL DB, obviously if your table's got those, it can't move out at the moment. Once the predicate base comes in, being able to partition or to be able to select just the columns you want to stretch, I see some of that being able to change, and you might say, if I'm only selecting these columns to be stretched, then it's going to be valid. The constraints and indexes that it doesn't recognize. And just some bits around the table properties. And again, a lot of it really is focusing in on what's available in Azure SQL DB. It has to be able to fit into that. So a lot of the restrictions are going to be based, you know, more around that rather than the stretch technology itself. A good way of doing it, rather than on an individual basis, the upgrade advisor, there's actually going to be a function in that where you can examine your database and see which tables are candidates for stretch. So pretty much the process around how it's working, it sets up your remote endpoint into Azure, creates an Azure SQL database up there. You select your table that you want to stretch. It'll create a replica of that table up into SQL DB. It then splits it up into your local data, and on the regular process, it works out what the eligible data is to be pushed up to Azure, and it'll then go ahead and push that up so that you've got the remote stuff up there in Azure. So let's have a little look at how that works. Instance I wanted. That's the issue with having a few VMs. It's working out which is the right one. Work off this one. Okay, so this order tracking database, the order tracking table, we've got that set up where it's obviously been checked to make sure that it's got the right structure to be able to stretch. So the first bit I ask you to do is make sure that the database has got a master key, and this is the bit that's then going to manage your encryption up to Azure and in place up in Azure as well. So really important that it has that aspect to it for your security. So if we look on this, you know, we've got a couple hundred thousand records to migrate up to Azure. At the moment, it doesn't allow us to do anything in changing whether it's all rows or not. So there's no predicate option at the moment. That will come with a later version. So it checks everything is okay. It gives you this warning about the fact of the primary key. It doesn't prevent it, it just says that it's not going to be enforced. So then just sign up to your Azure account. So the other bit, and it's a bug at the moment, it's one that I found in putting the demos together. You'll notice it doesn't have the Australian regions in the list at the moment. It's an oversight, it is available, it should work to the Australian regions, but there's something that, you know, has just regressed in the code for this one that they haven't put it in the list. The bug's been fixed, so it'll be the next CTP release. You'll be able to then select the Australian region from the drop-down list. The alternative is to do it through T-SQL. So this is all T-SQL commands to do the same stuff as we're doing through the wizard. And through that, you can actually select the Australian region. So if you wanted to actually get it running locally, that would be your way to do it at the moment. So the question? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It can all be done through T-SQL as well. The wizard doesn't actually create the script, so you have to go and do it from the actual commands and check those and look them up. Again, that's something that's been that I've submitted as well to them to say, you know, it'd be nice to go through this and then have it scripted so it's then repeatable for future use. So at the moment, let's just send it up to Asia there, and we'll create a new server. And then obviously, you know, create your firewall rule for Azure. Are you is everyone familiar with Azure SQL DB and how the interaction goes there with the firewall rules? It restricts things down. So there's a couple there. But what it is, obviously for that extra bit of security, if you create an Azure SQL DB, it puts a firewall onto it. And you can then say there's only certain IP addresses that are then get access to it. So it's another way of just narrowing it down. If you know your external IP from your corporate network, you can say that that's the only IP address that then gets access into this and make sure that it stays secure rather than being open to the public. To make it simpler on this demo, if my numeric keyboard was actually switched on, we'll just open it up to the world for now to save working out what it'll still work, I'm assuming. Just in case though, it might be that this is a 26 dot something network and then my whole thing will fall over. So at this point here, this is where it'd be nice to obviously have the script option and put it out into the T-SQL commands. The other bit that would be nice, and I don't know if you looked at the difference between SQL DB and the old portal and the new portal, where there's different ways you can actually name this the server. You'll see where it's provisioning it at the moment. It gives it that nice horrible name. It would be nice to be able to add that in and actually specify this is the name that I want, so that when you then go to the Azure portal and you see it listed there, you know exactly what it's for, rather than going, you know, who's created some weird database up in this instance. So it's been a little bit slow today. That's certainly not the speed it usually goes at. There we go. It's kicked down through now. Yes, it's still definitely slower. We've had a lot of comments that the network connection out here hasn't been too great this week. Has anyone found that with the Wi-Fi stuff? So what we'll do while that's going, make sure you can see this. There we go. Okay, so that's now been created. As we can see, if I come up onto the portal, there's my SQL database. So we can see it's the stretch one there. By default, it will always create it as an S3 instance. So be aware of that in terms of what you're initially going to get. There's nothing now to stop you going and actually resizing that instance. So if you know it's actually going to be just a small amount of data and you're a real slow incremental feed into it, you might want to go and drop it down a tier level and, you know, reduce your charges a little bit further. So that's completely flexible. There's nothing that says it has to be locked into an S3 instance. So if you remember from when we were looking at it at the outset there, it had something like about 188,000 records in it. So you'll see there, you know, it extends it out. It's probably started pushing things out already. So I'm showing that's added a little bit of latency to the query by pushing it out to 7 seconds. But as you can see, all the rows are still queryable. So we've got access to the full table there. There's a couple of new DMVs with the RDA, which Remote Database Archive, I think it's meant to stand for. So just to check on how things are going there. So when we look at that, it's telling us here's what's happened in terms of our migrations. So the timings, I think, are on UTC time. Haven't worked out whether there's a way to actually change that specification. I think that's tied in with all of Azure SQL DB that's always on UTC time. But as we can see, each time it's kicked in, we've been migrating about 5,000 records at a time. Which looks as though it's then probably be pretty close to done on most of it, I would thought. So a question there about whether the stuff in Azure SQL DB is queryable separately. No, it's not. So that's part of the security aspect of it, that I can't hook into that Azure SQL DB separately and run a query against it. It's limited to the only access being from the system process. So it's the way of just adding in the security aspect of it there and to stop people trying to mess with the data once it's up in the archive. Yes? No, it runs, I think it's every 5 seconds, I think, that it actually wakes up the background process, which then checks to see is there any records, and it will select just a limited amount so that it's not clogging up too much of the bandwidth that way. So at the moment, whether it does everything, yeah, because we can't put a predicate in, it will want to do everything, but it won't do everything in an entire batch. Because it's too much of a load that way. What it wants to do is do it as a trickle in the background so it doesn't use up a great deal of resources. So it will happen over time that we'll get there. And if we look at that, I mean, that's it almost done already. So the question is whether it does any tuning on the bandwidth that's available. Not that I know of. That I don't think it's smart enough to be able to detect that. But with it doing it as just a trickle feed, it's not doing a great deal of work anyway. So whatever it is sending up, it might just take a little bit longer, obviously, on a slower connection, but it's trying not to move too much. And if that process is still running by the time it's next due to wake up, it won't run as it won't spawn a second process. It'll wait for that one and do no work on that next iteration. No, so then your question is, can you tell it you just want to do it as a big bang? No, because it's a separate process that will run to do that. It will do it as a trickle feed. Yes?
So the other question is, what would happen to any, say, schema changes on the on-premise table? So say if trigger is created on the on-premise table.
Okay, so the question about any schema changes, as mentioned in the earlier slide, they're not permitted at the moment on the table. So once it's stretched, you can't actually make a schema change. So the way you would go around that is to create a new table with your new schema and then do a select into from the stretch table. It will bring it all back on premise, so it will be a little bit slower because it's got to pull it all out from Azure, but it will then put it into that new table with the new schema, and then you can restretch that one again and push it back up again. So then you would just delete the original table, which will deleting the whole table will delete the records in Azure as well. Okay, so the next bit I want to go through is some of the new backup solutions in Azure. And there's certainly been a lot of good enhancements that they've done around that. So starting off with SQL 2012, you had that option to back up to Azure Blob Storage, and they introduced the backup to Windows Azure tool so that you could run it as a separate application, which would be able to pull things out and run the backups up to a URL. 2014, added support in with Management Studio, so you can now do it directly through the backup wizard there, and also introduced managed backups to Azure. Has anyone made use of the managed backups at all? Never even looked at it. So what that is a process that looks at the size of your transaction log and the throughput on it and your recovery period, and tries to work out how frequently it should be sending taking the backups. But it also can then send those up to Azure as well. Personally, I'm not a big fan of it. I don't think it gives the right level of flexibility. I don't think it's really there with the level control. But in terms of my backups, I'm a bit of a control freak anyway. I want to know exactly when they're going so that I know has it all worked exactly as it should have done. And the latest enhancements, they've changed the format of the Azure blobs. You can now back up to a block blob instead of just the page blobs. It now allows you then to stripe those. The managed backup has been enhanced. And then if you've actually got your VM in Azure, is everyone aware you can actually then, rather than having your data files within the VM, you can say that they're actually in separately as blobs in Azure Storage. So effectively, when you create the file, you create the file as a URL. So that's a nice way of being able to push them out there onto your Azure storage, put them on premium storage there if you want as well. It keeps them independent from the size of your VM, and makes it really easy to move them about. I mean, you can then detach and reattach them to any other VM practically instantly. But with that setup and having them in blob storage, it then opens up the Azure Storage snapshots as a backup option as well. Some of the enhancements with the block blobs, there was restrictions on the size of a page blob, which was 1 terabyte. So effectively, as soon as your database got above 1 terabyte in terms of the backup size, you were stuffed. Nothing you could do with that. Just really about the size there, which then says, with the individual blob size being 195 gig, but they're stripable. So effectively, by striping it across multiple blobs, you can get as big a size of backup as you need. The other bit that's then changed with that is previously you would have used your key, your master key for your storage within the credential to do the backup to the blob. Now it makes use of the shared access signature and removes the need to actually specify the credential in the command, which is really nice. So it just looks like a standard backup command, except you specify a URL. It's smart enough to then know that that's the credential I need to go and use for that particular one. The snapshot backups, it needs the files to be hosted in Azure Storage and blobs there individually. And what happens, it's not like a traditional backup, so it changes the whole format completely, that it's not there with the data, but pointers to the snapshots in Azure Storage. It has to be in the same storage account that your database is using. That's the only restriction. It can't go across storage accounts. But effectively, the way that works is it takes a first full backup, and that is a traditional .back file, so that's got your data in there, but then everything is the pointers and the snapshot differences beyond that. And effectively what you're doing is it's almost like you just take ongoing transaction log backups of the snapshot, because it contains the whole thing in the backup. And the restore mechanism becomes different as well, that what you then do is you specify two subsequent snapshots. So you work out the point in time you want to restore to, you get the snapshot immediately before that, the snapshot immediately after it. You restore the first one with no recovery, restore the second one with your point in time. So the whole paradigm about what you actually restore changes. So for a point in time restore, you no longer have to go and say, give me a full backup and a whole big chain of transaction log backups to my point in time. You're now just specifying two files. So let's have a look at some backups. Okay, so I've just got a couple of databases that I've set up here. So the first bit is really just looking at the difference in the different blob backups. So the first one is the traditional one. It's using the standard storage master key to do that. With that one, the bit to note in there is we have to specify the credential. We have to go and create that credential beforehand with the storage key aspects there. So if we look in the properties of that, it's telling us what our storage account name is, and then the password is just the key value for that. The other ones here, the other two credentials, this is a different format that it creates when you do the shared access signature. So there's a format there which will do it and creates that. So in terms of that, it's the map between the credential name and the URL that works out which signature it needs to use for that. So looking at the basics of it on there, we can now see that it just becomes a backup database. You don't have to remember which credential do I need to use for that. You just specify the storage location and it works it out. And then the other option here, looking at that in terms of there it is with striping on there as well. So I did a test on that. I'm going to actually skip through a little bit because we're tight on time, I think. I did a test on that earlier. What I found was it's on about a 3 gigabyte database, so it's not massive size at the moment. You'll probably see differences when you scale up to larger databases. But the initial one onto the block blob, so the second query there, I found was just marginally slower on a smaller database. Now that might just be on that particular size, hasn't quite hit the sweet spot. But certainly once you go to striping, you do see it starts to get an improvement in time and performance on that. The one I do want to show you though is looking at the snapshot backups, because it's definitely, you know, far more fun and a bit sexier. So the first bit here, just to show you that you know, we don't have anything in the way of snapshot backups for this database at the moment. And the first one we do, this is just more of a standard database backup, which is just going to give us our baseline. And all the snapshots then run off this baseline backup effectively. So looking at that, it now gives us two snapshots to start with, which is effectively the database and the transaction log backups that are in there. So that's our first bit underway there. So I want to look at this this table in here. And if we look at that, just over 4,000 records in it. So we're going to add a few more into there. So all this little bit of code is doing is just doing it in batches of 75. Doing some inserts into that table and pausing a little bit between them. So that's going to run for about a minute. Now, when I start that off, I'm going to run with this as well. And this is the bit where we're actually doing the file snapshot backups. So the syntax, again, is just fairly simple. We're just specifying the URL and with this file snapshot. So as long as it's got that baseline to start with, it knows how to do that. So to do the corresponding between them, I'm going to run this while that those inserts are running, and I'm going to run the backups every 15 seconds. So we get that sort of backups happening while all the data loads going in, so we can get something happening at particular points in time. So let me kick off that one and kick off this one. The other nice bit that they've added into Management Studio. If you see this bit down at the bottom, it's given us an Azure Storage Explorer within Management Studio, which is really, really nice. So it's just another option from Connect there to Azure Storage. Just specify your storage credentials, and then you can explore in there and see what you've actually got. So a nice way of seeing, you know, with your backups, I can look at that and actually get the list of everything that's there within those various containers. So with my nice slow connection to Azure, it takes a little bit of time to refresh there. But as we can see, there's my snap backup initially. And these are the ones coming through from this process here. So that's now completed. So we had 4.4 something previously, I think. Oh, my inserts haven't actually worked there. Looking at that, that's exactly the same number of records. So let me see if we can run this again. Running. It's not going to make a difference with the number of snapshot backups. We're still going to be able to have that variation through them. So I'm hoping that I see with this that we're getting this number of records in with the file name, so we've got a decent reference there. That's better. So we can actually see with the backup file names, we can see that it's actually including that increased record count on those as well. So based on that, we've got some more. What I want to do then is with the final version here, so we can see we've got 4814. If I just copy that up for reference. And let me just pick a couple in here. So let's go. Unfortunately, the one that I'd like to do is be able to do a drag and drop across from here, but it's not got that exposed at the moment, which means I have to work it out with my poor eyesight and work out the timestamps on these. So let's go with 20, 10, 10, 34, 21. So we'll take change the number on here as well to make sure that's right. 4514. And the next one is 4589. The first one is 4589. It is actually, I've looking the wrong one above it. Thank you for that. 4739. And that is 3437. Okay, and if I set my stop time on that to be between those, so let's see. Let's make that at 30. Okay, so what that should then get is that once we do that restore, we should have something between 4589 and 4739 on the record count. And if I've put all these, sorry? It has done, yes. So, you know, something is not quite right on the timings, because it's still on the, oh no, that's right, that's local time. So that's actually 10:34, that's right. Yes, that looks as though we're good now, so glad we caught that before running it. It's always horrible when your demo fails with a nice error message. That's because I'm in there. At least that's a nice easy one to recover from. So previously with that, so there was four transaction log backups there, and we were going to a point in time during the last one. So we would have had to have done a full database backup and those four transaction log backups. So as we can see, doing it with the two here is definitely far simpler, and obviously overall that is going to be, you know, far quicker to do. So it's just finalizing that second one, and that's completed. And there we go. We've got 4664. So again, it fits nicely in that range between 4589 and 4739. I think we're out of time, so and just a reminder on your session evals, which is something I appreciate very greatly as a speaker. It's the way that I get my feedback and information from you guys as to how the session went, what's good, what I can improve on it. So please fill that in so I can see how you thought of it. The other standard stuff I'm sure you've seen before, the recording will be on channel 9 if you want to watch it again afterwards. See my happy smiling face up here, nice and awake at this time in the morning. And your other bits in there on the trials and evals and whatever. And thank you very much. Any other questions? Awesome. Thanks, guys.